Welcome to eHealth Learning, inspiring professionals worldwide.
All right, so welcome everybody, and this is our first in the series on the social nervous system, or the polyvagal theory and its application in clinical practice. And I'm John Wilkes, and I'm based in Dorset. And I first came across this work really through the craniosacral training that I did at Karuna. And then when I started to organize the Breath of Life conferences, and we invited Stephen Porges in 2009. So part of this presentation will include an extract from that talk. And in the other two webinars that we're going to do after this, we'll have other extracts from his 2013 talk as well. So with me we have Elmer Posel, who's in London, and Julian, who's in Portugal. Elmer, do you want to just say a few words about how you came across this work?
Thank you, John. Yes, I'm a therapist, craniosacral therapist, and birth-oriented therapist, living and working in London. And I came across this work indeed through the Breath of Life conferences in London, which you were running at that time. And I was very inspired by Stephen Porges, and I went up to him after one of his amazing lectures, and I looked at him in my face kind of like, what do you see? What do you see in my face? And I was like, and he said, slow to rouse, he said, which meant that my kind of smiley wrinkles were further, a little bit more distant, you could imagine. So that was very helpful and a very inspiring man. And I've sort of crossed paths with him a number of times since, and always been impressed by his wonderful way of working and being, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I love the way he integrates the science with very kind of real, you know, social interaction, and he kind of embodies it in a way, doesn't he? In a very beautiful way, and he sees all the implications for so many factors in our lives, you know, from intimate relationships to therapeutic relationships to work relationships. Yeah. Julian, do you want to say something?
Yeah, briefly. My name's Julian. I run Embodied Health Community with John Wilkes. And the last time the three of us gentlemen were together was filming the birth conference in Bristol. So it's nice to see you again, Elmer. And yeah, I did a degree in body work, and I came across the work as part of the training there. And I asked my teachers who inspired them and where I could find more on their teachers and inspirations. And they pointed me in the direction of the Breath of Life, which is where I first met John and was introduced to some of the theory from polyvagal Stephen Porges. And other than that, a training with Ellen Heed, who we've had on here, where we looked at some of the work of Peter Levine and the social nervous system with tracking, and to gain some insight into when we're talking to our clients, what we might be noticing be going on for them. And I found that very interesting. So I look forward to exploring more tonight. And in my practice, I do therapeutic body work and some embodiment coaching. So I think this is relevant for a lot of us in our practice, movement and body work based.
Thank you. Thanks very much. And I should say that also Elmer is the filmed these conference presentations. So he's the man behind the camera. So I'm going to start with a little presentation just to give an overview of the polyvagal work and social nervous system. And then we'll go into the video extract, and then we can have a little discussion between the three of us. And also, if you've got questions from the anyone who's watching, you can do that as well. So I'm just going to get this up now, start sharing my screen.
Yeah.
So the neuroanatomy of the social nervous system. So this is sometimes described as the polyvagal theory, and I'll describe why it's called polyvagal. As we said, we're going to feature Stephen Porges, who is a professor of psychiatry at University of North Carolina, amongst other things. And that's his website there, stephenporges.com, if you want to see what he's up to. So he kind of has been around for quite a long time. As we said, we had him at the Breath of Life conference in 2009. But more recently, he's really kind of hit the headlines. I don't know if you saw this. This was in June in The Observer, I think, or The Guardian, with a fantastic interview, if you can find it, with Stephen, about why different people react to trauma in different ways. So, like, for example, he talks about, so why would someone who has to give a talk be absolutely comfortable with it, and someone else will kind of freak out and feel that they're about to die? So, you know, he talks about that in that article. So this was in June. But I suppose over the last few years, there's been a whole host of books come out about the vagus. And I was just trawling through Amazon, and I was absolutely amazed at the number of titles there are here. And a lot of them talk in their titles and in their content about activating the vagus nerve or waking it up. Of course, if you didn't have an active vagus nerve, you probably wouldn't be able to function very well. It's kind of crucial for your survival. You know, it's part of what we call the autonomic nervous system, which is there primarily for survival. Anyway, so all these different books, and of course there are various techniques that they teach. And we had Stanley Rosenberg on fairly recently about his book, which I'll talk about the vagus. But here's a few more. I like that one, The Reliable Vagus Nerve Handbook. And of course, there are various ways that you can, I suppose, activate your vagus nerve, if that's a good idea, through vagal nerve stimulators, which are being used quite a lot in research now for things like headaches and migraines and chronic pain and all that kind of stuff. So you can see there's a whole host of them here. This one is the one that Stanley Rosenberg wrote, which I think is really, really helpful. It's very practical for therapists. He is an osteopath himself. If you look in our back catalogue, you can find his talk about this. I'll show you a short extract from that talk a bit later if we can as well. And he has worked quite a lot with Stephen Porges over the years, particularly working with autistic kids. And I know that's a real passion for Stephen about that. And he'll talk about that in some of the extracts that we present as well. Stephen has also written a book himself, this one, which is quite intense. I don't know if you've read that, Elmer, but it's pretty hardcore and difficult to read. also his the Pocket Guide, which is a little bit more accessible. Also this one, which I think is very good, The Polyvagal Theory in Therapy by Deb Dana. And if you look on YouTube, you can actually find quite a lot of stuff with Deb Dana, and she managed to explain the whole polyvagal thing in a very clear way. So we're going to start with a little bit of anatomy around the vagus. So the vagus nerve is both mixed sensory and motor, and that's why Stephen talks about it as bidirectional. So it's receiving information from our body constantly, but it's also has a motor component to it as well. It's from the Latin, which means wanderer, so it's a very, very long nerve. From the brainstem to the colon, the transverse, more or less the middle of the transverse colon, actually. And it's the longest of the 12 cranial nerves, primarily parasympathetic, and I'll explain what that means. And the core thing that to do with the polyvagal theory is that it has a lot of connections with other cranial nerves, which we'll look at very briefly. I'm not going to talk much about anatomy now, but it's just the basics of it, just so you understand some of the language that Stephen uses. So it has particular connections with the trigeminal nerve and the facial nerve and the accessory nerve, and these are the ones as well which we'll look at. That's a common kind of diagram that you see of it. This is from a book called Cranial Nerves, and you can see that it exits from through the jugular foramen here behind the ears, goes down the neck, goes to your heart, goes to your lungs, then goes through the diaphragm next to the esophagus, and goes to your stomach and the liver and all these other organs that you have. And the small intestine, and as we said, part of the large intestine. And part of its function, the word parasympathetic, the word para actually means against. So it's kind of has its, one of the functions is to inhibit, you could say, the action of the sympathetic nervous system. And you see this particularly in the upper part of the body through, like with the heart, it's going to slow it down. It's going to slow down your breathing and deepen your breathing. But below the diaphragm, it's kind of doing something a little bit different in terms of stimulating your digestion. Yeah, so that's what happens when we give a lovely cranial or Bowen treatment or something else and people's stomach starts gurgling. That's the parasympathetic part of the vagus stimulating your digestion. And likewise, it's it has an active role in things like urination and sexual arousal and that kind of thing too. So these, when we think about the autonomic nervous system, we often think about these kind of old kind of charts, which are not that accurate really, but they kind of show the spine and all the spinal nerves going to the organs. These are the sympathetic nerves going to organs. And then the parasympathetic, which is mostly the vagus, the bottom part of the body is coming more from the around the sacrum. It's a different part of your parasympathetic system. So Stephen's work really is to do with these three parts. He identifies three parts of the vagus really and the autonomic nervous system, which are related to our development and our evolution. And they also have what he calls a hierarchy of control to them. So the new vagus that you can see on the left, this is a myelinated vagus. It's in evolution, it's much more recent. So you see this in mammals and things. It has a different, it's sort of controlled by different nuclei, particularly in the front part, the ventral part of the vagal complex. And it's all to do with social engagement. This is why it links in with certain key other cranial nerves to do with orientation, to do with moving our neck, for example, our eyes, particularly expression in the upper part of the face. And it also has connections with the inner ear and the heart and the throat. And that is kind of, you could say, our ideal kind of resting state should ideally be in this new vagus, yeah, which is all to do with social interaction. And the reason for that is because we are social beings. You know, we had to develop that to survive, really. We can't survive on our own. And so this is all part of the evolutionary process, enabling us to create social groups, to be able to relate, so we can then feel what is going on with the other person that we're relating to on a kind of unconscious level. A lot of this is happening on an unconscious level. And so in a hierarchical and evolutionary way, the sympathetic system was, again, earlier in our evolution, you could say. And that, again, is all to do with survival. And as you probably know, the sympathetic system is often called our fight or flight response. And this is all to do with getting ourselves moving away from danger, fighting, and this is to do with increasing our heart rate and getting more blood to our extremities and away from our gut. Yeah. And it's very much linked in with things like adrenaline and cortisol. So these kind of can flood our systems. Yeah, we've all experienced this. So it's not like when we talk about going from, say, a more socially engaged place, which could be described as our ventral vagal place, yeah, or more into our sympathetic system, it's not like a sudden switch you can go from one to another, because a lot of this is mediated by these very important things like adrenaline and cortisol flooding around our system. So in evolutionary terms then, the old vagus, which is the unmyelinated vagus, which you see in very kind of primitive creatures, and you see it obviously in reptiles. And if you think about reptiles, they're not particularly social. If you've ever had a tortoise or a snake, you'll know it doesn't show much in its face. It's not very socially engaged. And so this old part of our vagus we still have, and it's still part of our survival mechanism. And that survival mechanism is primarily to do with kind of shutting down. And some people talk about dissociation. Stephen Porges talks about it in terms of, you know, it's our last resort survival instinct. If everything else doesn't work, if it doesn't work running away, and if it doesn't work being socially engaged, we go into this old part, which is survival, which often, you know, you see in mammals, they play dead. Everything kind of begins to shut down. And you get a flood of all kinds of chemicals in the system, which create a sense of everything kind of shutting down. So there's a kind of stage of hierarchy to this, which he talks about, which is the myelinated vagus, the ventral vagal complex, or sometimes the nucleus ambiguous. I'll show you a little picture of this so you can get an idea of what we're talking about. And part of this whole thing of this is to regulate our sympathetic nervous system. It keeps it under control, if you like. So one of the things that Stephen talks a lot about is the need for safety. And this is particularly true in our work as therapists, obviously, because without safety, a sense of safety, we're kind of always on the lookout a little bit for predators, yes, for danger. This is what we're hardwired to do. And he talks very eloquently about that and how that's linked in with certain kind of noises in our environment, particularly low noises. And so part of the idea of the new vagus is to keep the sympathetic nervous system in check. And it does that in quite specific ways. For example, there's a very tiny little muscle in your inner ear. It's like about a millimeter long. It's a tiny little thing. And that's kind of linked in with a lot of these cranial nerves. And part of its function is to filter out these low frequency noises. And so you see this can be affected in certain situations like in autism, for example, where some autistic kids have a lot of problems filtering out low noises. And the idea of that filter is to filter out predator noises, if you like. So it's to allow our sympathetic system to slow down and for our social nervous system to come into the fore. And the key thing here about this is that there needs to be safety in order for that to happen. So in the hierarchy, you'll see that the sympathetic nervous system is below this, and then below that you have the old system, which is controlled by the dorsal motor nucleus, which is to do with immobilization, if you like. So this is all about the fact that we are relational as mammals. And our need to create safe social bonds. And I was going to show you some of these pictures because I love them so much. So these bonds are not just between humans, but between animals and humans and between animals. And one thing that Porges talks quite a lot about is things like immobilization without fear. And you see this in a lot. So this is the sympathetic system in action, but it's safe. And he talks a lot about this in terms of therapeutic process as well, and ways of using play. This is a very beautiful picture of two bears doing that very beautifully. This picture is slightly different. This is mobilization with fear. You can see this is, you might have seen this picture. It came out recently. It was from the Wildlife Photographer of the Year. I think it was the winner, but it's pretty impressive. That poor animal, I'm not sure what it is, not the fox, I mean, the other one, unfortunately didn't survive that encounter, apparently. And and probably would have gone into his or hers parasympathetic system where he plays dead. And Porges talks about this as being in a state where you don't feel anything. Yeah. So, and this is immobilization without fear, right? So this is very different from a sort of old vagal immobilization where you're kind of stuck and frozen. Immobilization without fear is a very social thing. And we see this also in intimate relationships, and we see it in our therapy situation. This is a picture of me with a mother and babe. And obviously, you know, they're in a very safe environment and their nervous systems are very calm. They're not in their old parasympathetic state. They're much more in their ventral state there. And of course, you see this with animals. I love this picture too. This is another one from that series of two lions. And you can see also that face-to-face interaction, which is so important in this eye contact and reciprocal facial expression, which is so important to create safety. And again, it's something we use a lot in our work. So just to go over these quickly, what we're talking about are these cranial nerves, the 5, 7, etc., the trigeminal, which, as you know, is to do a lot with the face. It's a lot with the things like the forehead and expression in the upper part of the face, the facial nerve, which also has links in with the inner ear, and the glossopharyngeal. This is very much linked in with vocal expression. And again, Porges talks a lot about things like prosody, how when our ventral system is more engaged and our social nervous system is more engaged, we use much more prosody, intonation, inflections in our voice. And again, we can use this in our therapeutic situation too. So nerve 10, which is the vagus, and then the spinal accessory, which is to do with neck movement. So this is your mainly controls your sternocleidomastoid muscle, this one here, and your trapezius muscle. So this is again to do with orienting, to moving towards. Babies use this a lot in orienting towards mum, etc. So they're the nerves there, and they basically, that the theory behind this is more than a theory, it's a sort of anatomical reality, you could say, is that there is complete interaction and shared anatomy and functional overlap between these nerves. For example, the glossopharyngeal, which is 9, and the vagus and the accessory share these nuclei. And this has particular ramifications, which we'll see. So just a few terms that Porges uses here. I did this little, what I call vagal dictionary. So prosody, we've talked about. He uses the word phylogenetic, which is probably a word you haven't heard of, but it's to do with evolution and how our nervous systems evolved in response to our needs, yes, for survival, particularly. So for example, the seal, I recently discovered the seal has a very interesting evolution, actually, because they use a lot of facial expressions. If you look at a seal, it's beautiful, and particularly in the upper part of the face. But anyway, the seal, started as a fish. This is a joke, by the way. It's true about the seal, but this is a joke. So it actually came out onto land and evolved as a land animal, and with short, stubby legs, and then for some reason decided to go back into the sea, possibly like this fish here. So the other terms that you might see here are, yes, the sympathetic nervous system. This is an interesting term. I often wonder why it was called the sympathetic nervous system. Apparently it was from some anatomist in the 1730s. He thought that these little nuclei and ganglia to do with the sympathetic nervous system were little brains. He called them little brains. and that the fact that they worked in sympathy together, which is actually true, because they all kind of work together. That's why it was called the sympathetic nervous system. And then the parasympathetic was, as we said earlier, like something that works against the sympathetic to kind of calm it down, which is also true. Another term that he talks about is the vagal break. This is the way that the new vagus acts to keep the sympathetic nervous system in check. And that, again, this is very interesting because you see this playing out a lot in our clients. For example, you might have found that people with chronic fatigue syndrome or ME, often they have problems with this in the sense that their sympathetic nervous systems can often get out of control. They can feel like they're just running on empty all the time because there's something happening in the vagus here which is not keeping it under check, if you like. And these nuclei here that we talked about here, this is a little picture here of the brainstem and just showing you where these nuclei are back here. And you can see at the back there, you've got the dorsal motor nucleus, the central nucleus, and then further forwards, you've got the nucleus ambiguus, which is the newer part there. And you can see that they're affecting the things like the middle ear, the throat, the back of the tongue, and of course, very strong connections through to the heart. Yeah. And particularly the way that this is expressed through the upper part of the face. This is a very nice picture of George Clooney. And you can see that his smile is very genuine. And most of this is happening behind the eyes. You can see here in the forehead, as opposed to this man, where it's all in the lower part of the face. And this gives us the impression, perhaps, that it's not entirely genuine. So that what we're reading here is primarily the upper part of the face. And you can also see this happening, interestingly, in cartoons. I saw this yesterday, actually, from a children's book. And I thought it was very beautiful. Those of you who've got young children might know this book. I didn't, but I was a little good at it. And you can see here, but those creatures, I'm not sure what they are in the middle, those white creatures. But they don't have anything in the lower part of their face. There's no smile or anything, but we can still read their expressions from the upper part of their face, from their forehead. I love the forehead expression of that little creature on the left, whatever he is, and his eyes and the wide eyes. And again, Porges talks a lot about this. The movement of the eyelids are involved with this, the wide-eyed expression, the forehead, and the ears and the gestures with the hand. And you can just by looking at that picture, you can see what each of those creatures there are expressing, yes, through their heart. And we can see this also with babies. I'm just going to show you this little extract from, it's called the still face experiment. And I love it because it shows very clearly the effect of face-to-face interaction with babies and how they respond to it. In fact, all adults do this, but babies show it really, really clearly. And in this little experiment, it's quite an old one now, a mother is interacting with her baby and making a lot of, you'll hear prosody, so intonation in the voice, and primarily a lot of face-to-face contact, a lot of facial expression. And there's a lot of interaction going on, a lot of play going on, yeah? And then all she does is just turn away and then comes back into eye contact, but she makes no facial expression and no sound. And very quickly, the baby goes then into its sympathetic system. That's the kind of next default level, you could say. So it starts to cry and become noisy and, so it's a very clear expression of this. So I'm just going to go to this one now. This is I think he's a psychiatrist called, is it playing? Yes.
Babies this young are extremely responsive to the emotions and the reactivity and the social interaction that they get from the world around them. This is something that we started studying 30, 40 years ago, when people didn't think that infants could engage in social interaction. In the still phase experiment, what the mother did was she sits down and she's playing with her baby who's about a year of age. And she gives a greeting to the baby. The baby gives a greeting back to her. This baby starts pointing at different places in the world, and the mother's trying to engage her and play with her. They're working to coordinate their emotions and their intentions, what they want to do in the world. And that's really what the baby is used to. And then we ask the mother to not respond to the baby. The baby very quickly picks up on this. And then she uses all of her abilities to try and get the mother back. She smiles at the mother. She points, because she's used to the mother looking where she points. The baby puts both hands up in front of her and says, "What's happening here?" She makes that screechy sound at the mother, like, "Come on, why aren't we doing this?" Even in this 2 minutes, when they don't get the normal reaction, they react with negative emotions, they turn away, they feel the stress of it, they actually may lose control of their posture because of the stress that they're experiencing.
Okay. I'm here. And what are you doing? Oh, yes. Oh, what a good girl.
It's a little like the good, the bad, and the ugly. The good is that normal stuff that goes on, that we all do with our kids. The bad is when something bad happens, but the infant can overcome it. After all, when you stop the still phase, the mother and the baby start to play again. The ugly is when you don't give the child any chance to get back to the good. There's no reparation, and they're stuck in that really ugly situation.
So, another extract. So you could see that quite clearly, couldn't you? Going from that socially engaged place very quickly into the sympathetic place, and back again into the social place. What Edtronic's here talking about is if that's not possible. For example, if a mum is very depressed or unavailable, then that's much more difficult because the baby's not getting that kind of social engagement. Stephen Porges also shows this one, which I really love, and this is a famous little video of a little baby, and the mum sneezes, and the way that Stephen talks about this is that partly the sneeze, because it's a low kind of frequency sound, puts the baby into quite a bit of a shock, and you can see it goes into its kind of startle and its sympathetic system. And the fact is also that she's also covering her face with her handkerchief, so the baby can't see what is behind it. So it's just, and then she takes it away, and it comes back into social engagement again. It's actually a very funny little video, this one.
Baby.
So Lastly, just another thing that Porges talks about is the development of what he called, you know, so-called social media. And he talks about, you know, the fact that it started with the telephone, where we kind of lost our face-to-face engagement, but you could still hear intonation in the voice. And he talks about how with our things like Facebook, etc., that face-to-face and the prosody has gone. And so you get into quite a strange situation. I'm just going to stop by just showing you a very short extract from someone talking about the development of Facebook and particularly how this plays out, which I find very interesting. So one of the things this was an interview with a guy who was one of the first investors in Facebook. And he talks a lot about how Facebook and Google consciously try and get people more into their sympathetic nervous system in order to engage them more. And this is something you see a lot, don't you, for some reason in social media, people tended to get very angry, yes, very impulsive. And I mean, I've had this myself, you see, even on some kind of, you know, therapy groups, Facebook groups, it should be all, you know, love and light. It tends to go often a bit pear-shaped. So it's going to pay you this. This is, if I just find the right place here. Sorry. So this is an interview with, I just surprised, yes, this guy here. Roger McNee, author of a book called Zucked.
Explain its threat to democracy, Roger.
Very simply put, the way that Facebook works, and the same would be true of Instagram and YouTube and Google search engine, they need you to spend a lot of time. And so the first thing they do is they use notifications to build the habit. Once you're addicted, once you're coming back multiple times a day, they have to find ways to keep you on the site. And the simplest way to do that is to reinforce whatever content gets you to share or like or comment. It turns out, for most of us, the content that does that is stuff that triggers flight or fight, which is essentially a part of our psychology that's so deeply wired we can't avoid it. The content that does that best is hate speech, disinformation, and conspiracy theories. Effectively, what happens on Facebook is they bombard you with the stuff you react to, and it blocks out all other forms of communication. So you wind up in being in what is called a filter bubble, which is essentially an artificial reality where everything appears to reinforce the things you already like or the things you already believe, and it blocks out any new ideas. And in a democracy, that's terrible because it increases polarization. Essentially, each one of us is in our own Truman Show, and if we're not careful, we wind up having our own set of facts. And you see this every day.
Great. So we're going to move into this extract now, which is about 10 minutes long. And we'll put up the links to the full DVDs, which you can get from Elmer, from Whole Being Films. So we're going to show you part of the 2009 presentation that he did at the Breath of Life Now. He also did one in 2013 as well, and a whole workshop. And maybe you could say a few words about that while I get this up, Elmer. You're muted there.
Yeah. So the recording we have is a 2-day masterclass with Stephen from the Breath of Life 2017, and that is a masterclass. It's very lovely. He takes his time and walks through the material very gently, and it's great. I mean, it's a stunning way to learn the material, really. Don't know what else to say about it other than it's a powerful thing. It's when I was working on that. He came into the room we were working in the same room. He was coming up to get something ready for his presentation, and I ended up having a chat with him. And I felt very, his prosody was extremely prosodic, and I felt incredibly safe with him and very happy. It was a very lovely experience. He is the real deal, I think.
So here he is. This first webinar really was to give a general overview of the polyvagal thing for people who don't know much about it. So this is him explaining how he kind of got into this and the basics of it. Here we go.
It's lost. It's not that it's not in the literature, but it's in the scientific literature. It's not in the clinical training. So if you go to a pulmonologist and ask the question, what nerves are regulating the lungs? They don't really know. They see the lungs as mechanical organs. If you go to a GI person and say, tell me about the vagal afferents, which is loaded with, they say, well, there must be. And if you ask the question, what happens if the GI system is distorted or damaged or inflamed, is that going to affect cardiovascular function? There'll be a moment of silence. They say, I don't know, assuming that they're honest with you. The point is that the clinical medicine is not learning about the feedback loops about how these systems work. And this has a lot to do with the separation of the autonomic nervous system from the brain and the loss of respect, or I should say that's my bias, but the loss of understanding of the sensory importance. So all of you who are interested in manipulation of touching are also very interested in afferents, sensory input. And when you touch the body, you're not just touching the afferents of skeletal muscle. When you press on the body, you're affecting autonomic afferents. The whole issue of the polyvagal theory really came about with this whole concept of what I'm going to call the vagal paradox. In the early 1990s, I wrote a paper that was published in a relatively, well, a good journal called Pediatrics, in which I described cardiac vagal tone as being protective in newborn babies. And that if you had more of this cardiac vagal tone, the outcomes were better. I got a wonderful letter back from a neonatologist, and the letter went like this. I really enjoyed your paper. It's a very interesting paper. However, when I went to medical school, I learned that the vagus could kill you. Okay. Now, it was a very insightful experience for me to contemplate what he was writing about. Because being very interested in vagal activity, it was clear that if you had more modulation of the heart rate, which is vaguely mediated, the babies were healthier. There's a big literature in that, and I was doing this now for decades. But there was also a clear literature that bradycardias, the slowing of the heart, and the apneas, the lack of breathing, were also clinical risk factors. But they were seen, and they were also vaguely mediated, but they were seen in different populations. So healthy full-term babies with lots of beat-to-beat variation in the heart rate were doing well, while babies who had flat heart rates, where there was not much spontaneous beat-to-beat, were the ones that are basically at risk for those bradycardias and apneas. So he ended his letter by saying, I guess too much of a good thing could be bad, meaning that they both could be vagal, but maybe too much isn't good. Now, I was very perplexed by that step.
Sorry, this is going on to another extract now, so this continues.
Because I knew it couldn't be true, because it was really, one was good, one set of processes, and one was actually killing, just like the Holford paper of sudden death and the paper that I mentioned by Kurt Rick. And so I then went on a quest, my own intellectual quest, into the bowels of the library. And I had an appointment at the National Institutes of Health, which was very useful because it enabled me to go into the stacks and have easy access to the National Library of Medicine. And in this quest, I was trying to find out about the embryology and the phylogeny of the autonomic nervous system, because something didn't make sense to me. And what it amounted to was the development of a new theory, which showed that we really had two vagal circuits. We had this old one, which gave us bradycardias and apneas, and he was absolutely right about that. But we also had a newer one, which produced the beat-to-beat variability, the respiratory sinus arrhythmia, but that one was linked to the striated muscles of the face and head. So that social behavior was the way or the portal into this newer circuit, while basically defense and shutdown and inescapable death was the way of eliciting the other. So what we are left with in the theory is really that evolution is our organizing principle in terms of understanding how the autonomic nervous system works, that we have three neural circuits that form a phylogenetically ordered response hierarchy that regulate behavioral and physiological, and the take-home word is adaptive, adaptation, to safe, dangerous, and life-threatening environments. And how do we get those responses? Well, our nervous system is evaluating risk in the environment and tries to match physiological state with that nervous system identification of risk. And what we, if we start looking at the phylogeny of the system, what we start seeing is that we have, start with our newer circuit, which is this new myelinated vagal circuit. And myelin is a fatty coating over the nerve that enables more rapid communication and transmission. So you can have much tighter, rapid circuits. And that the cells of origin where this nerve starts is in the ventral vagal area. It's ventral to where the old vagal circuit is. And it's linked to social communication, self-soothing, and calming behaviors. And it actively inhibits basically stress responses. But everyone in this room knows that, because by triggering this circuit, you calm down and you deal with stressors, whether it's through breathing exercises, whether it's through listening, whether it's through singing, or even whether it's through talking. You're eliciting these circuits. And often we use other people to help us get this circuit moving. So social interactions get this circuit going for most people. The other circuit, if this doesn't help us calm down, we actually have a circuit that is very defensive. It fights. It enables us to effectively protect ourselves by fighting or fleeing. And when that circuit doesn't work, we start using our very, very old vertebrate history, which is to immobilize. Okay, this is not immobilizing like deer with the headlights. This is immobilizing like a mouse in the teeth of a cat. Okay, it's death feigning, but the mouse doesn't say, hey, I'm going to fool that cat, I'm going to play dead. This is an involuntary response. And what we'll find out is that humans often have a similar involuntary response. They may pass out, they may defecate, it's the same circuit, and or they may dissociate. Okay, we have those three circuits. And now we go to the roots of the model. One of the roots is from an English neurologist by name John Skewling Jackson, who discovered it was very enthralled with Darwinian concepts of evolution. And John Herbert Spencer came up with a concept of evolution in reverse called dissolution. And Skewling Jackson applied that to brain damage. And so when we have brain damage or brain disease, there's a disinhibition of older circuits. Now, what I've done is taking this concept of this dissolution and applied it to how our autonomic nervous system works. So the autonomic nervous system first works by removing this safety circuit. So the safety circuit is really, it's a brake. It dampens our mobilization. It makes us efficiently use metabolic resources. It's for health, growth, and restoration. It's social. It regulates our face. But what it does, it also turns off our defensiveness and our perception of predator. So our first response is to pull off this defensive system. It enables us now to be at a state which can be triggered if a predator is there. And if the predator is there, it will trigger a mobilization circuit, as opposed to when the vagal brake is on, it's going to compete with that. So stimulation of the mobilization circuit is really increases in sympathetic tone that facilitates fight or flight behaviors. Now, if that doesn't work, so if we're in inescapable environments, fight or flight doesn't work, like the woman on the airplane. There's no place to go.
I used to actually describe meetings with the dean. When the dean, we used to have chairman meetings, and I was a department chairman at one time. I said it was like sitting in the middle seat on a crowded airplane. You don't want to be there, but it's inappropriate to leave. It is inescapable. And so dean's meetings I used to view as inescapable. So that's how that got into this theory. Okay. So there's an adaptive surge in the immobilization circuit, and this raises pain thresholds, conserves metabolic resources, and functionally prepares the organism to die. It prepares the organism to die without pain. Okay? So what I really wanted to tell you is, because you probably have lots of clients who have experienced something like this, the first thing I want you to tell them is to celebrate their body's reaction, so they don't feel like they were betrayed in going to this response, that their body did a heroic event in trying to preserve them from pain. Okay. However, getting them back into social engagement strategies is more difficult. And the first thing you do is celebrate what the body has done. Another way of viewing this is that we have a sequence. The sequence when we are challenged is first we use our head, our social communication system, and this is this new ventral vagal complex that includes the muscles of the face with the myelinated vagus. So we try to negotiate our ways out of trouble. If that doesn't work, we use our limbs, we mobilize with our sympathetic nervous system, and if that doesn't work, we shut down. And this hierarchy fits into this model of dissolution. And now you're ready for your anatomy lesson. Okay. And this is the only anatomy lesson that you'll get where your eyes will not roll up, okay? It starts with a conceptualization that the body has three parts, okay? It has a head, it has a viscera, and we're going to lump the trunk and limbs together. And the model will be that each one of those three components has its own autonomic nervous system. We have the old vagus, which is primarily the vagus of the viscera, primarily, okay? Digestive system does its job well. We are not really aware of it. And when we're aware of it, it's not working right. It promotes vasovagal syncope, better known as fainting or swooning. And if the baby comes into the world prematurely, it's coming into the world not with this new mammalian autonomic nervous system, but with this older circuit. So the neonatologist who wrote me the letter was right. The defensive responses of the preterm baby are apnea, lack of breathing, and bradycardia, slowing the heart rate up. So the preterm baby is not a full-term baby in miniature. The preterm baby is a human being with an undeveloped autonomic nervous system with features of a reptilian autonomic nervous system. So the new myelinated vagus doesn't start coming in until after 30 weeks gestational age. Okay, this requires a different set of behaviors to treat preterm babies. So touching them, which is really kind of what people want to do, can potentially stimulate, create bradycardia and apnea. This is the second stage of development, a sympathetic nervous system, which has cortical representation of limbs, and then we regulate. Whenever we have motor movement, we have on our spinal cord, there's an interplay with the sympathetic chain, and so sympathetic nervous system supports mobilization. And we can see this in flight behaviors, we can see this in fight behaviors, we can see it in aggressive, or this is a dysfunctional child, and we can even see the hands coming up. We can even see this in full-term babies because that coordination is there. And I want you to remember later in the talk, I'm going to show you something similar, that adults still have a very similar pattern. And finally, we have this cortical bulbar or cortex to the brainstem area that regulates all the striated muscles of the face and head and is linked to a myelinated vagus that goes to the bronchi and goes to the heart. And we can see the circuit working. It's there at birth in full-term babies, and it results in some very interesting social interactional behaviors. And of course, it's used for self-regulation. Now, what I wanted to talk briefly about is a question that I ask my medical students.
Okay, so we're going to come back to that a bit later and in the next webinar. We've gone a little bit over time, I'm sorry, so it always takes longer than I thought. So we can open up for some questions and a bit of a discussion for 10-15 minutes, if that's okay. Elmer, do you want to say anything about that? Or I know you wanted to say something from your own experience about the sympathetic nervous system. And your sound is off, I'm afraid.
Okay.
Cool.
Yeah. Well, in the so with my colleague Binny Dansby, I run a training which works with the breath a lot to do with healing. Really, the first impressions that we have when we come in. So, as we've seen some pictures of babies there, and they, when we come in, we sometimes can quickly and decisively make a very, as Stephen's describing, a very, very instant decision to close down or to look after ourselves, really, to survive. If the situation is not conducive to feeling like we're surviving, we might well decide to close down. And in the work with the with clients or with members of the group and with ourselves, one of the key things is that the breath helps regulate the system. It helps remind us that we are in choice, that we are, that those autonomic shutdown states that we might have originally chosen can be consciously worked with from the present, in a reminding ourselves of a healthy present. And when sometimes it can be quite a strong reaction or response, or if you hold the birth, lots of birth work works like this, and cranial work works like this, you create an optimal psychological, physiological safety, and in which then in time the unhealed stuff will arise in its own way, in a manageable way, so that it can be released. And one of the key things in that process is eye contact, and the safety in this bit is absolutely critical to helping people just choose to stay here. Mm. Breathe, you know, breathe, take a breath, stay here. I just wanted to say that absolutely what Stephen's describing with the upper part of the face and that's part of the co-regulation, so that there's a constant reminder of a co-regulated state.
Yeah, he talks quite a lot, doesn't he, about the breath and how, like, particularly long exhalations help to stimulate the ventral vagus. As a musician, I get that a lot when I play the flute, you know, particularly things like Bach, when you're playing these long, long, long phrases and you have to take big, big breaths. And the calming effect of that is really remarkable, actually.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very good.
Okay. So are there any questions that we've got coming up? If anybody wants to ask any questions before. I know you wanted to say something from your own experience, did you, as well?
I had a very particularly sort of powerful experience recently. I was in Brussels visiting the European Commission and building, and a man, I want to keep this brief because it could be a long story, but it really is a brief story. A man came up to me and started talking to me and told me about some appalling betrayal by the European Commission and by politicians and so forth. And I stayed in relationship to him as opposed to pushing him away. I listened to him closely and did my best to receive him. And I thought, in other times I've thought, oh, here we go, you know. And this time I stayed open to him. And at one point he said, I'm going to set fire to myself. Okay. So, oh, that's a very powerful and strong thing. You know, that's strong. And I sort of related, and I stayed open, and I related that to his experience with his children. And how are you going to help your children if you do that? You know, and 45 minutes later, he came back with a can of petrol.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And I had the experience of really being in a very therapeutic sense, in a way, kind of compassionate. And at the same time, I could see he was doing something which was really problematic. He was, and I knew what he was going to do because he'd told me what he was going to do. And I had the experience of going from at rest into a sympathetic, I mean, absolutely immediate kind of, and I knew I was doing it, and I knew that this would probably have some long-term or longer-term cost than I was in there. And I ran into the situation and made a lot of noise and attracted the attention of the security. And I kept on saying to him, I believe you. And I looked at him and I said, I believe you, because he was his complaint. And I supported the reality of his complaint through eye contact. And it helped. Hmm. It helped delay. And I tried to grab the lighter out of his hands, but it helped delay I stayed relational. Hmm. It was a very powerful experience. And he didn't manage to set fire to himself, thank God. And eventually there was kind of enough people turned up, and eventually there was a wonderful picture of the fire brigade turning up with a great big hose pipe. So like, if you do this, we're gonna hose you down. But I it's relevant because when I mentioned going on a similar trip to a friend yesterday, my heart rate instantly rose.
Wow. Yeah,
like, whoa, yeah. And I can feel it. It's quite strong. I just wanted to bring it in because it's relevant to the level, the kinds of activation. I don't feel I went into the dorsal.
Yeah,
I didn't go there. I went into ventral and sympathetic, fully sympathetic activated.
Yeah.
I thought it was an interesting example of a dramatic but caring activation of a thing, of the nervous system, really. And I didn't, in that moment, I didn't see my own danger particularly.
Yeah.
I somebody shouted to me, get back, because petrol is petrol, you know. So
that's interesting. Yeah. Now, I mean, it's so interesting how this has ramifications, and I found it, you know, for all kinds of different relationships and therapeutic relationships as well. Mm-hmm. I remember many years ago, we were working with a couple of little boys, brothers, and that kind of really got me interested in this. Really, was one of the boys was very aggressive at school, and the mum had brought the boy for that reason. So basically he was in his kind of sympathetic, but his brother was very, very withdrawn and was doing some quite destructive things, but in a kind of very quiet way. So it was interesting that working with the elder brother, where he quite quickly went from this kind of, you know, hitting teachers to being more socially engaged, and the teachers would reflect that very, you know, to his mum. But what happened with the younger one was that he came out of his, you could say, more old Vegas, where he was withdrawn and almost self-harming. It wasn't actually self-harming, but it was like that. And then as he came out of that, he went into his anger, you know, right. So for the monk, this was quite difficult because, oh my God, now suddenly he's the aggressive one. And it was a question of sticking with that, you know, and seeing that through and being with that, and then going over a period of time into a more socially engaged place. So it was a very clear kind of process that, and that's what Porges talks a lot about, this kind of hierarchical thing. And you see this a lot with people, don't you? I find very interesting when people perhaps go into those kind of states which are very, very stuck, very kind of withdrawn. And I really like what Porges says there, like it's not, you know, this old vacancy, it's not like you're pretending to be dead. It's not like something you can control. And one of the things that I find sometimes working with particularly maybe people who are stuck in, I don't know, it could be depression or chronic fatigue or any these kind of quite closed states sometimes, that they can, it's difficult to get out of it because everything fights against that in a way. Like, this is your safety, this is your survival. To move out of that into your sympathetic system is potentially a very dangerous thing to do. So therefore it's much easier to stay where you are. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's not like people don't want to get better, but that's movement from real kind of shutdown to engagement. And that's why I love the way he talks about that in terms of like, mobilization without fear. So like getting into play and the way we in therapy we use social engagement to get people out of that. I think it has amazing ramifications, this really, right across the board, I think. And particularly socially, I mean, that extract about Facebook and stuff and this polarization that we're seeing now is very much linked in with his stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, we should probably stop there, and then we've got another one in a couple of weeks' time. Where we're going to be concentrating on safety and what Porges calls neuroception, which is his term. And we're going to look at some other extracts. I've got a few extracts to show from the 2013 presentation where he talks about that. Great. And Elma, if you want to join us again, that would be really fantastic. I won't be talking nearly so much next time. So
it's been great. It's fantastic. I love this. It's great.
Cool. Thank you very much, all of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And see you in a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah.